Welcome to Cornell's East Asia Conversations, a podcast that captures the latest thinking on issues of contemporary and historical East Asia. We share stories, experiences, and research grounded in multidisciplinary approaches to East Asian and international studies. This podcast is produced by the Cornell East Asia Program. Today, we have a guest from the Cornell Contemporary China Initiative Lecture Series, taking a moment from their visit to speak with us.
I'd like to welcome you to today's podcast from the Cornell Contemporary China Initiative Lecture Series. I am Jack Zinda, and I am an assistant professor in the Department of Global Development at Cornell University. And I'm here today with Michael Hathaway, who is an anthropologist at Simon Fraser University. He will be giving a talk that is entitled Transforming More Than Human Economies in Southwest China. I would like to thank the Polson Institute for Global Development, the Environment and Sustainability major, the Department of Global Development, and the Department of Anthropology at Cornell University for helping us to bring Dr. Hathaway out here.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Wonderful. I also am really glad to have you out here to join us and talk about Matsutake mushrooms and their global networks. I'd like to start by asking, what drew you to the worlds of Matsutakes?
Okay, it's interesting. I grew up being kind of curious about mushrooms, but in a social context in which people really tended to fear them. As I've been doing some research into the topic, I found that of all the cultures in the world that we know about, that the British were likely the most phobic. There's even a term called, they have a mycophobia, a fear of mushrooms, a hatred of mushrooms. And I grew up in a, Anglo-American community where people were really nervous about me ever to try one of these wild mushrooms on my own. But nonetheless, I was curious about that, had a little bit of basis, started to eat a few things and learn a bit. And then I went out to the West Coast for my undergraduate program, and I went to University of California at Santa Cruz, and that place was just a mushroom mecca. So many people that were crazy about them, a lot of old Italians that I'd go hunting with and others, and I started to actually gather mushrooms for the what's called the fungus fair in Santa Cruz. And that was under the auspices of David Arora, who is one of the world's most prominent amateur mushroom hunters, but has written what many call the Bible of mushrooms, called Mushrooms Demystified. And it's a 800-page tome, and it is scientifically just dead on and also hilarious. It's like the funniest field guide you've ever seen. So I was connected into this world. I was also working at that time even with Anna Singh, an anthropologist at Santa Cruz, and she had finished her first book in the realm of the Diamond Queen in Indonesia, and then a book called Friction on changing aspects to capitalism and environmentalism around the world. And she was trying to think of another project to rethink globalization, trying to find some object that would be an interesting way to explore how globalization worked in kind of potentially surprising ways. And one day she had a conversation with David Arora and just mentioned this kind of question. She had this quest, and he said, well, of course, the answer is Matsutake. and she didn't really know about this mushroom. I knew just a little bit about this mushroom. And he said, this is part of this now huge global chain going all over the world, and all these people are interacting with it in really different and interesting ways, and you might want to look into that. And so Anna Singh started checking it out, and then she invited myself and then a handful of other people who were oftentimes her former students, but not necessarily, and we started a collective project together.
So it sounds like you came to mushrooms before you came to the Tibetan Plateau.
That's right, I did. Yeah, I was already kind of mushroom attuned, especially through my undergraduate days. And then landing first in Kunming, in the capital city of Yunnan province, as you know, that was just so mind-blowing to me, just because I was used to seeing two or three kinds in the stores. And there were dozens of kinds. And I'd go out in the woods, and it was just thick with people hunting mushrooms. And they knew a lot and ate a lot, and there was such a pleasure. And I had experienced almost none of this kind of mycophobia that I was used to. Instead, there was this celebration of them. And you'd go to the airport, and you'd find 10 different kinds, all dried, and of very different varieties. And it was such an interesting place. And then where I did field work for my thesis at two places, and the northern place was on the edge of the Tibetan Plateau, as you know, and it was just on the edge of the Matsutake economy. So I'd hear little whisperings of it, but I visited some of the places up north in what's now known as Shangri-La, but I didn't really see it. So it was interesting to be in a place even for a year and be on the edge and just barely hear about it. But I had no idea that there was this huge pulsing economy that was so powerful, just, you know, footsteps mm-hmm. away, really. Seasonal economy, yeah. too.
And that's funny because by the time I got introduced to Yunnan in 2007 and 2008, everybody was talking and writing about Matsutake. The first thing that people did was, go and talk with people who were gathering those mushrooms.
Yeah. Yeah, it was such a big thing. I remember actually at one point in the year 2000, I was in southwest Yunnan, and that was there was a Dutch project that I was mm-hmm. part of and working with, and they were just starting to recognize the potential for mushrooms then as part of an economy. So mm-hmm. then it was called non-timber forest products. But it was generally thought of as something that, you know, the state forestry workers could just let the villagers have mm-hmm. because these were basically worthless. There was no idea of their potential value.
Well, yeah. Could you say a little more about just the, mm-hmm. the transformation mm-hmm. that surrounds Matsutake in that area?
Sure. Yeah, it's a really interesting case. And it's hard to find if there is much of a historical demand. So as you know, Dan Winkler, who's an expert, especially on this amazing mushroom, the zombie caterpillar mushroom, the caterpillar fungus just mm-hmm. up north of there, he showed me a citation he had that there were evidently tons of Matsutake shipped back a long, long time ago. But my guess actually is that it's another mushroom of a name that was a synonym for that, and you know, probably it's something else. We don't quite know, but all the stories that I basically heard was that up until the 1980s, people really didn't care about Matsutake. There are well over 100 kinds that grow up in those areas, and people said, you know, it was never the favorite. It was something kids would gather. They would sell for 5 mao, just like 50 cents or something like that, on a stick. Nobody really cared for it. Said it was better to have tofu in the pot, but Matsutake were okay, just kind of adding in its float. Nobody really craved the mm-hmm. taste. And then it's still a little bit shrouded in secrecy. There's some interesting stories about how Japanese researchers came to this area and maybe started some of these markets, bringing it to Japan, letting people know that actually it was incredibly valuable. But basically, by the late 80s and by the 90s, it just the value started to grow and grow. And by the mid to late 90s, it was just something only in the places where Matsutake just grows on its own in an abundant way, those places became transformed by this mushroom. And in the late summer and the fall, you just had first thousands, then tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands just waking up early every morning and going out to the mountains to pick this mushroom. Some people said we kind of fell under the Matsutake spell.
And these are places where before that people had very little cash income.
So little, yeah, just kind of amazingly little. Like, I mean, remember just looking at the poverty rates in the 90s and thinking it was like 40 U.S. dollars a year per person. So just such low cash potential. There's a little bit with the yak herders was selling some of the cheese especially, and sometimes the yak meat. But even, you know, in the mid-90s, foreigners were often not even allowed to travel to these areas. It was still closed. You had the beginnings of the domestic tourist economy. But yeah, there are so few ways to make any money. Mm-hmm. So Matsutake became one of the first pretty simple ways to make money that didn't require owning land in a certain way. It didn't require investing in seeds and fertilizer and all these things. It was something else. Yeah.
And it made so much money. I mean, mm-hmm. I love that paper that I think David Arora wrote called The Houses That Matsutake Built, about these mansions, these enormous wooden and daub houses that now sprinkled in those villages that were lucky enough to have abundance of matsutakes.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think it's a good point that you bring up, too, that they're lucky enough to have matsutake, and they often get thought to be something that's agricultural or somehow grown or produced, and they're really, really not. Mm-hmm. Although there is a new vision of them occupying a kind of what I would call a third space that's coming from Japanese researchers, somewhere between cultivated and wild, and that idea is starting to come into China, but nonetheless, they haven't really been intentionally cultivated or fostered in any way. And to see these houses and which are just huge, beautiful, you know, carvings, incredible paintings, and to think it's almost solely from this one little mushroom is kind of amazing.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to your mention of this contrast between this area and where you came from, and this mycophobia. And I'm wondering, what is your sense of what is behind these just dramatically different relationships that people have with mushrooms?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And the term itself was coined by this investment banker named Gordon Wasson, and he was of British stock himself. And he was actually up in upstate New York when he started coining the concept, was first alerted to this possibility. And he had a Russian wife, and they were just so newlyweds walking through the woods. She saw a number of mushrooms from the trail. I still don't know what species they were. It's not written down that I have seen. But she just went crazy and was gasping, was so in love with seeing them. And, you know, growing up in Russia, where mushrooms are the thing, there are even special trains that traveled just to bring the urbanites out to mushroom hunting during the season, just basically purely for that. And he went out there and was like, what are you doing touching these disgusting things? What's going on? But it led to this lifelong quest. So besides being an investment banker, he became obsessed with mushrooms. He came up with this theory that cultures are mycophobic, some are mycophilic. Some of the only other mycophobic cultures out there that he saw were some far in the Arctic, like the Inuit. Some Inuit people had a certain kind of nervousness about mushrooms, and there aren't too many big fleshy mushrooms up there anyways, really. But so in some strange way, nobody really knows why the British ended up calling it the most loathsome vegetable. Vegetable vermin, they called it. And they just really seem to fear it, despise it, associate it with rot and decay. I mean, and certainly in England with its damp climate, I mean, their homes were being destroyed by fungus, that's true, whether or not they realized that these were the same as the kind of fleshy ones that they saw is, you know, unlikely for a while. But one thing I'm curious about is the degree to which this deep fungophobia has maybe inflected the history of science around mycology. So that's one thing I'm looking into now. But and that really hasn't been researched, and it's kind of hard to figure out those exact linkages. But it was a very widespread phenomenon throughout the UK, although we do have amazing British mycologists. But going into China, too, is just a culture that is really alive and attenuated to this huge range of flavors, of varieties of mushrooms. And it's even to the degree that I'm living now in Vancouver, and our mycological society, we have this wonderful mushroom walk that takes place just in Chinatown, where we go from store to store and we find dozens of different species of fungi. And a lot of these are being shipped from China, and the demand in the Chinese diaspora is still strong.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that we mm-hmm. can get king mushrooms in Ithaca too. When I first started hearing about matsutake mushrooms, a lot of the conversation was related to this question of them being a thing that's harvested as a non-timber forest product, as you mentioned, right? And a lot of people were saying, oh, they might be this thing that is over-harvested or the harvesting might bring other damages. There are a lot of fascinating things about matsutake that raise questions about that picture. And I'd wonder if you could talk a little bit about that story.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, I think it's so fascinating because you're exactly right. The fear of over-harvesting was so, so big, and that motivated so many of these regulations and laws that came into place. And there was a really interesting situation with matsutake where at some of the original endangered species conversations, there was a question raised a while ago, can mushrooms become an endangered species? And actually, China and Japan were two countries that struck down that very question. You know, we're obsessed with the animals, and then after that, the plants and fungi are far, far behind that in terms of the general kind of Western consciousness of that. But then, you know, as you know, China, especially through the Yunnan-based conservation of the endangered species organization, they push for matsutake to become listed as an endangered species, which is really interesting and had certain effects in terms of the trade. One thing that I've really noticed in kind of digging into the science is that usually our ideas of sustainability are based on other forms of life. And that's one thing that I'm really intrigued by is the diversity of these forms of life that have different ways of reproducing that are so qualitatively different from our typical understandings of how things grow and die and the populations occur, that they might exist in a different space, that our ideas of sustainability are built on certain kinds of familiar animals, that the way that we treat them, are they of a reproductive age, for example, or not, all the hunting laws, everything around this. But fungi might operate by a completely different logic that eludes that. And I think that's part of what I'm interested in, is challenging some of the scientific precepts that we think we know that may be based on an invisible animal model, and that instead, if we think through fungi, we might think differently. But I'll just say one quick thing about this question of over-harvesting. There's a really interesting case, and I don't know if you've heard this, but David Arora shows up, you know, he comes several times, and there is all this conversation around, oh, look, matsutake the numbers are falling. It must be over-harvesting. That's why we need... This is right before the endangered species legislation came through. And he starts looking at these charts, and people are showing the numbers are going down over the last 2 years. And they said, yep, must be. We're over-harvesting. Need to clamp down on this. And then he says, okay, let's look at the numbers that are being harvested of matsutake. Okay. Then let's take a transparency of the price that's offered in Japan, and let's see if there's any correlation. So look at that. As the price goes down, the mushrooms go down. And then then the next year, the prices went up and the mushrooms went up. So David Arora was, you know, having this interesting view. He'd already kind of fought some of these fights already in the Pacific Northwest where the government was trying to clamp down. And he's more of a kind of, you know, let the people do their thing and don't worry about fungi sustainability as long as the habitat is protected. But he said the mushroom pickers, his general sense, are fairly innocuous as long as they're not digging down. So like truffles may be a totally different story. Mm-hmm. But if they're just slicing the mushrooms and taking them off, they work and propagate and divide under a very different logic than many others see. I mean, so he raised this question that they were still designated as endangered. Nobody really listened to David Arora's, you know, his argument in that case. But it still remains kind of uncertain whether even the most intensive picking will have any negative effects. But I find this sensibility so strong mm-hmm. around this question of over-harvesting.
So for the people mm-hmm. who do the harvesting mm-hmm. and live in those areas, mm-hmm. Do you have a sense, are there any ways in which the phenomenon of the matsutake has changed their relationships with those places where matsutake grow?
That's a great question. I think so, for sure. So one thing is that, you know, it went from something that was just something that you just find when you're just picking other kinds of mushrooms, you throw them into the pot, into a much more sustained, daily, intimate interaction with their own local environment. Usually people are just walking a few kilometers away from their village starting early in the morning, and they need to get back by around noon or so for the dealers to come. So there's often this kind of morning sensibility. I mean, one thing is it's affected their relations to that forest. And as Emily Ye talks about, it has created some real antagonisms between villagers who live in a matsutake-rich area on one side of the mountain and a matsutake-poor area on the other, and debates about whose forest they should historically claim, because, as you know, in the 1950s, all of the kind of village land claims were kind of transformed radically under the commune period. But one thing that I did see this really changing people's lives are those families that sold off their yak herds, that basically said, we are done with yaks and we are all in on matsutake. And so that ends up being a major transformation of people who have basically devoted for hundreds of generations, perhaps, this deep entanglement between the needs of yaks, their birthing, their milking, their pasture, protecting them from wolves, growing food for them, all of these forms of really fascinating entanglements that really, this is a yak-mediated landscape. It's funny, I remember reading recently to people talking about this as a human-mediated landscape, and I thought, well, humans with yaks. It's the yaks eating certain plants and not others over thousands of years, and that's what yaks are, the big landscape transformer in the broad way. Humans will make little patches of fields, but really it's a yaki landscape. And so those people that have gone in for matsutake and abandoned yaks, that's a really big change for them.
Yeah. So your visit is part of a broader series about China's environmental transformations. I'd like to ask a question. What do the things that you have learned about matsutakes do to illuminate or change what people usually talk about when they talk about environments in China and Asia?
Oh, thanks. That's a great question. I think one thing is that usually environments are conceived of in terms of being relatively passive, relatively inert. It is people that use them, people that abuse them, environments that need protecting. And I think sometimes this certain way of imagining the environment, usually as a separate thing from humans, which is also a fundamental problem, really it reinforces a certain perspective on the wider natural world as operating as a more clock-like way, in a more mechanistic way, in a more passive way. And so I think conversely, looking at these fungi and how they are transforming the environment themselves, how they're not just an inert thing growing that may need protection, or an inert thing that can just become a human-only commodity, which is, I think, you know, inflects the vast, vast majority of the kind of research paradigms that we've taken towards environmentalism, to think how these species are shaping these ecologies takes us into another way to understand to explore, even really at the beginning, the kinds of agencies of these other species that humans are also trying to accommodate. So it also helps me then look at yaks in a really different way. It helps me look at other kinds of species like pigs, or think about their vulnerability to African swine flu that's just rampaging through China right now. These are all these kind of interspecies relations that I think are often forgotten, often unacknowledged, in our typical ways of thinking about the environment as something that it's really that it's there. Humans are using it, abusing it, protecting it, managing it. But there are all these other things going on. And it was really actually my first research project with wild elephants, and trying to think of how wild elephants were becoming dangerous animals, were starting to attack people in the early 2000s, and how that really challenged elephant conservation. The elephants were just sitting there and passive and not harming anyone. Just let them increase and multiply, and that's great. But there was something about the elephant's behavior that was then shaping the possibilities of international nature conservation efforts. So I kind of came at the mushroom question through my work with wild elephants. And with wild elephants, it was much more easy to see their agency, how they harmed people, how they destroyed houses, how they ate different crops. But it took a while for me to think about these forms of kind of fungal agency that are much more subtle and different. So it took a lot of reading by mycologists to help me to understand other ways to see these species. But now I can imagine them in all species, and trying to curious what a kind of environmental outlook would mean if we took these more than human agencies and lives more seriously.
Well, I look forward to learning more about these ways mushrooms may change our thinking about environments. Thanks a lot, Michael, and I look forward to your talk later on.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jack. I really enjoyed it.